They've been treating issue after issue after issue after issue. Anything ever fixes itself, and it never really will when you're on a drug. Drugs are not there to fix you. They're there to remove a symptom. And if you're on them chronically for long periods of time, they're usually going to result in additional symptoms.
All right, Kate, welcome. Let me just say how awesome it is to have you on the show. You have been such a pioneer in the world of metabolic healing. You have over 25 years of experience in the health and fitness industry. And I think I can speak for everyone that knows you and loves your work that, you know, you have made the topic of bioenergetics and stress and cellular metabolism super accessible and digestible for people that are actually willing to learn and kind of look at things from a different perspective. Your book actually was one of the very first introductions I had to this entire realm. And so it's just such a surreal kind of fangirl moment to have you on the podcast. And just a quick fun story, I remember like each new chapter was like, there's no way there's one more thing that I'm doing wrong. There's literally no way. And then I get to like the water chapter and I'm just like, okay, I'm doing everything wrong. So it was just, oh my gosh, the book was revolutionary for my journey. I think I probably told you that several times by now, but it's just such an honor to have you on the show today. And I think everyone else would super love to hear your story. So would you do us the honor of kicking us off with your personal health story a little bit?
Well, I'd love to. And thank you for having me. I feel like, and I was just telling these ladies a second ago that I feel like I know them from our social media world, but ditto on fans of theirs. I think you both are doing amazing work.
Oh, thank you.
But long story short, I kind of got into this world, like so many people, that things weren't going really well for me. So I'm almost 50. I was probably about 38 when the world that I had created around health and fitness was kind of falling apart. I was an athlete. I did marathons. I did long cycling events. I taught boot camp. I was very fit. I was in the world of the Paul Check world. So I had a decent diet, but it was basically void of things like sugar, milk, salt, anything white. And I was hitting about 38 and things started going a little bit sideways for me. I started to, I was having metabolic damage, cold all the time. I was having hormonal issues. I thought basically I go, this must be what 40 is like. Everyone was telling me when you hit 40, things suck. And mm-hmm. So I was hitting that age and I kept trying to make everything tighter, get a little bit harder with my diet, maybe work out a little bit harder and things just, it wasn't working. And until I got introduced to the work of Dr. Pete, and all of a sudden everything turned upside down for me. And I was like, oh my gosh, this is me. What have I been doing for the last 38 years? Mm-hmm. I've been basically putting duct tape on everything, working really, really, really hard, using my willpower, my commitment, all these things I really prouded myself with that were making actually my life a little bit harder. And so at that point in time, I flipped everything, as many people do when they get into this world. Didn't really have the best of outcomes initially. Things skewed a little bit haywire mm-hmm. for a bit until my health kind of settled down. But ultimately, you know, like many people, you hit a wall and you're ready and open to a new approach. And here it is.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I love your story because I think that Corey and I can relate to that on a smaller scale, but you were kind of pursuing that health and fitness industry that the two of us were just so much longer, right? So, you know, I know Corey and I both dabbled in kind of that over-exercising, undernourishing realm, but you think you're doing it right, right? Like everything's lean meat and low sugar and sugar-free, and you think like I'm killing it when it comes to diet and, you know, fitness. And so I love your story just of healing that you're in a place of such vibrancy now, because, you know, your journey was at least triple the time that ours was, you know, and just to see that you're in a place of just vibrant health and enjoying your life now is amazing. So I love that.
I always like to tell people like, yeah, well, what I always like to say is like, yeah, I had a lot of years of destruction. I mean, a mm-hmm. lot, and I've done a lot of different things to destroy myself, whether it's dieting or drugs or alcohol. I mean, if you name it, I have done it. And, you know, there was probably always highs and lows, and some things were, you know, as we all know, I would over time maybe do better diets than the previous diet, but we always know that you can get a better diet, might not be ultimately the right diet, but it can be better than what you're doing. So I did progress through that way. only to find each one of those diets always was hitting a wall some way. Mm-hmm. And so that's essentially what happened. So yeah, so I'm now 12 years into eating and supporting. And again, as my life has changed, I've had to adapt to it, but it's always been in a supportive manner, never with a restrictive mm-hmm. manner like before.
Yeah, I love that. That's actually a great lead into our first big topic. So let's talk for a bit about the big differences between the traditional modern medicine view of how a disease occurs versus how a more bioenergetic metabolic focused definition of disease would explain root causes. Because especially in terms of nutrition, you know, all three of us know very well, and probably most listeners know well too, there's just this extreme variety of health and nutrition advice coming from places like traditional Western medicine, you know, the FDA, and then functional medicine, and then various diet spheres. It's like, I mean, it's just an overwhelming list, and all of the approaches are so incredibly varied. But Kate, can you talk to us primarily how modern medicine and more bioenergetic based philosophies would differ in terms of the root cause of disease?
Yeah, Fallon, that's a great question. And I mean, the bottom line comes to, I think modern medicine looks at symptoms, and they're always about how can we rectify that symptom. They're never really understanding. I don't think they're really looking at someone's biology and how the cell functions. So in the bioenergetic field, we're always looking at down to the core of how is your cell breathing, essentially. And we're looking at cellular respiration, because we know that, yes, we breathe through our lungs, but also our cells breathe. There's an exchange of gas that occurs at the cell level. And so we're always looking at, okay, how do the cells produce, right, energy? Because it's the energy of life or anything that basically gets us going, that produces our health, that creates cell renewal, that creates hormones. Everything requires energy. And how do we produce energy? Well, through cellular respiration. Okay, well, what does that look like? Well, that means you need to have fuel. It means you have to have certain nutrients. It means you need to have oxygen. And when all those things are there and available and your cells can utilize them, because that's another factor, then you will produce a lot of energy that allows your system to work optimally. The medical world doesn't really look at how your cells breathe. I don't even think they understand it, to be honest with you. I actually just had a talk on another podcast that a doctor was on there. And one of the key factors that I like that this approach looks at is the point of carbon dioxide. And nobody talks about carbon dioxide except in this world. And I don't mm-hmm. think most people even understand carbon dioxide. But carbon dioxide is so important because in cellular respiration, we produce it. And in glucose respiration, which is our body's ability to utilize sugar, carbohydrates, glucose, we produce double the amount of carbon dioxide. Carbon dioxide is so important because that's where the exchange of gas occurs. And carbon dioxide exchanges with oxygen. And we need oxygen for respiration, not just because we're breathing it. That's all the medical world seems to look at, is you're breathing oxygen, cool, right? Well, what are your cells doing with it? And if your cell's not producing carbon dioxide and there's a lack of it, then it's not going to get enough oxygen, which means the entire world of respiration is going to be hindered. And so we look at that, we want to address that. We utilize measurements that you can take at home, like taking your temperature, your pulse, and then we look at factors, yes, that are symptomatic, but we want to see if they're improving. And those are symptoms like, how's your digestion, hormone function, how's your period, how's your libido, how's your detoxification, how are you able to maintain muscle, how are you sleeping, how's your energy? All of those factors we take into consideration, because if those things are good, then we probably know that your health is pretty good. For some reason, the medical institution doesn't seem to really either care or to know to ask those questions. They will look at your blood labs and see and how many people have gone into a doctor and they go, yep, labs are good, nothing wrong with you. And you feel awful, right? Because they're not even talking to you about how's your stress, how's your life, are you happy, what's your food, what are you doing? Any of those things are not even considered in that world. And so I think we've just gotten, like I said, and it's not necessarily their fault. I think that's what they're being taught in medical school. I think medical school has gotten very complex and complicated because now there's thousands and thousands of drugs they have to learn about and how they're acting and how they're, and so it becomes so much about the symptoms and how do we treat these people versus how does the body actually function optimally and what can we do to support that?
That was very well said. And you go into this in your book a lot as well of just, you know, depending on what condition people are used to talking about, you're like, okay, well, let's take a second and zoom out and talk about, you know, what the bigger picture might be to this. And that's kind of like one of the things that I know you for, is just the ability, like Fallon was saying, to take a very complex topic and make it really digestible and easy to understand, and also just getting wheels turning and being able to step outside the box and think about, okay, you know, what's the bigger picture involved here? And so that's why we thought it might be fun to, you know, talk on this episode about some of the most common health issues that we're seeing in, you know, modern America, or even on a global scale. And with that, maybe have a conversation looking at those through a bioenergetic lens. And so obviously none of this is medical advice, but we just want to invite you guys to think outside of the box as we go through these. And I wondered if you want to kick us off with hypertension, since that is, you know, one of the most common health issues and diagnoses that are happening today. And a lot of times what gets blamed for that is, oh, it's the salt that you're eating, or it's the cholesterol. The cholesterol is the problem. I looked at the World Health Organization, actually, just out of curiosity, what the latest and greatest was as far as recommendations. And that was still pretty much it. There's also, of course, don't smoke, you know, don't drink, exercise regularly. And I wonder if people just look at it like a list of to-dos like that, if they might not address the root cause, because they're like, okay, let me just go run more. You know, let me just cut out all of my salt and all of my saturated fats and possibly potentially do more harm than good in the overall systemic issue. So let's just talk about hypertension for a second. Do you want to take the floor on that, of just explaining, you know, the bioenergetic lens of what could be happening there?
Well, anytime anyone has hypertension, obviously they have high blood pressure. And so the question is, why do they have high blood pressure? And instead of, is it the salt? Because yes, there's more salt in the blood at that point in time, or creating more pressure, but is there something else going on? And usually it's the, is something else going on? And so obviously anytime you have high blood pressure, you're going to have it under times of stress. That's how our body reacts. Blood pressure increases. It's a systematic response for stress. It's our body's system saying, hey, we need more of everything. We need more fuel. We need more nutrients. We need more energy. So we're going to push it through. We're going to increase your blood pressure so that it can occur. So it's actually a positive response in the short time. And all our stress responses are positive responses. Like, we need these stress hormones. All of these things are good until they're bad, until they're in a chronic level and they're kind of circulating through our system all the time. So it's just kind of the same thing with high blood pressure. So under chronic stress, what seems to be happening is that our body isn't regulating properly at this point. That renal angiotensin aldosterone system is kind of dysregulating. And at this point, either could be sodium, right? And sometimes removing salt from the system can have a positive response. But usually if that is occurring, it's because most people under stress are eating a really crappy diet. And usually it's short processed foods that it might have high sodium, but usually have a bunch of other garbage as well, right? Usually there's vegetable oils, flours, additives, and they're just not quality food. So yes, removing that kind of stuff from your diet will improve your health. And people are like, oh, it was the salt. And I've seen that many, many times before. People are eating a severely highly processed diet, remove all those food and actually eat real food, and all of a sudden their blood pressure goes down. And they're like, yep, it was the salt. And I'm like, or it was all the garbage you were just eating, and maybe yes, you're not as stressed. So there's more than just one factor, because in a healthy system, you definitely need salt. Salt is there. It has so many supportive factors for the system. It's just having the right time and combined with the right foods. Eating whole foods along with a good white salt is going to be super beneficial to your system. It has so many good factors in it, and actually is supportive to maintain magnesium. We know it is important for inflammation. We know it's supportive because it helps keep aldosterone in place, which is a stress hormone. And anytime we can reduce a stress hormone, we know that's a good thing. So always kind of putting into context and what is really happening is super important. But for most people, if I would talk about hypertension, it's normally like, hey, if this is probably your life, do you have any stress right now? And what can we do nutritionally to support your stress? Because if we can, by eating the right foods and having the right salt and getting sleep and so forth, will be that usually the main factor of helping you kind of reduce blood pressure versus just removing salt.
Absolutely. I love this answer because, you know, I think we can all agree that like lowering stress is the right response to high blood pressure, but modern medicine is sort of lacking this comprehensive view of stress, right? Like, it's just viewed through an emotional, mental lens, not taking into account, you know, getting enough nutrients, getting enough of the right foods, you know, toxin overload, like all of that. falls into the category of stress, which is why this approach to me is just so, so important. And then the next looming health issue we want to discuss is high cholesterol, which hits really close to home for me because I was put on a statin at like age 20 because I had, you know, quote, hereditary high cholesterol. And I remember my doctor at the time grilling me whether I really was taking good care of myself. Like, I remember telling him, you know, that I ate well and I exercised. And he was sort of like, do you really though? Like, do you really? And there weren't any specifics involved of like, are you eating this way or that way? It was this blanket, like, are you taking care of yourself? And I'm like, yeah, of course I am. You know, I thought I was doing everything fantastically. I mean, I was running, you know, eating a low protein diet, honestly, in hindsight, you know, lots of grains, low fat, lots of processed food, you know, low sugar, like sugar-free alternatives. And I truly was convinced that I was pursuing health. And to be fair, I was doing the best I knew how. You know, I think all of us have sort of been there. But my nutrition view was just so off. So luckily I got pregnant a few months later after my doctor prescribed that. And so I came off super quickly. But in hindsight, I'm like, my doctor didn't even address my thyroid. He didn't run any thyroid panel. He didn't talk about mineral balancing. He didn't talk about the bioavailability of my nutrients. Like, none of that was talked about. So Kate, my question for you is, where has traditional medicine gone wrong in addressing this issue? Because, you know, in a world where, you know, eggs are too high in cholesterol and red meat is bad. And like, even if you look at something like Mayo Clinic, it says that it's a result of saturated fat, right? Like, it's all the saturated fat you're eating. That's why your cholesterol is high, combined with a few other things. But this is obviously the current medical view, is that, you know, it's just totally misunderstood. So where do you think the current advice has gone wrong? And what would you say is the truth behind having high cholesterol?
Well, again, they're like trying to address the symptom. So initially you're like, okay, cholesterol, we know cholesterol is in food. So if you're eating high cholesterol foods, that must be why you have high cholesterol, which we already know that I think cholesterol in your blood is maybe results from your food, make like 10%. So it's a very small measure of cholesterol in your blood is going to result into the food that you're eating. It's primarily by what your liver is producing. So your liver is producing a high amount of cholesterol. The cholesterol that your liver produces is the basis of all your steroidal hormones. We need cholesterol. It's a good thing. We need it for a lot of different functions in our system. However, when we become hypothyroid or under severe amounts of stress, we are no longer either producing enough thyroid or we're not converting it in our liver, because our thyroid obviously produces a thyroid hormone, but it's primarily producing the inactive T4. And our liver is our primary spot of where that conversion is going to occur into the T4 to T3 conversion. And then it needs that thyroid to convert cholesterol into your steroidal hormones. Or it also needs maybe vitamin A or other things that it might need to utilize cholesterol properly. So in a body that's, again, under stress, and under stress is usually very symbolic to low thyroid, because they basically are antagonistic to each other. You're usually going to have a low thyroid person have an extreme amount of stress in their system, which is going to normally result in they're not converting enough cholesterol, which is going to look like high cholesterol. And so if you look at like Broda Barnes, he basically utilized a thyroid therapy to help people that had either heart disease or high cholesterol by giving them thyroid hormone, not telling people that they need to be on thyroid hormone. But by doing that, it did lower their cholesterol. And basically, because again, we need it. It's just the high level and if we're not converting it and we have high amounts of cholesterol rapidly running through our system, and then we're also eating maybe a high PUFA diet, or we're not regulating our minerals properly, then we can lead to things like artery blockage, so forth. But is it really the cholesterol's problem? No, usually cholesterol is there to try to help the situation. It's the other things that are oxidizing the system or the inability to convert that cholesterol that it's creating the problems. So again, just looking at the symptom, trying to fix that, right? High cholesterol, let's just put you on a statin and then lower that. And unfortunately, statins can have an effect on the liver, which it can actually decrease the body's ability to either create it or do what it needs to do long term. So again, they're not fixing the problem. They're usually going to create another problem long term. And if you'll know anybody that's actually been through the medical system and been in it a bit, I mean, they have all sorts. They've been treating issue after issue after issue after issue. Anything ever fixes itself. And it never really will when you're on a drug. Drugs are not there to fix you. They're there to remove a symptom. And if you're on them chronically for long periods of time, they're usually going to result in additional symptoms.
Very well said. It's kind of like the cascade of interventions with pharmaceuticals. And actually, I remember from your book, you talked about whenever you started incorporating this way of eating, like it's a diet, but just changing the way that you were eating, your on paper cholesterol went up. And I wondered if you at the time understood cholesterol at that point, and like, or if you were kind of like, oh my gosh, what am I doing? You know, and kind of had that like back that previous mindset regarding cholesterol.
Yeah. I mean, it's interesting, 'cause I always had like a cholesterol number around 170, 180 ish. Like I thought it was super great. And I was eating like, you know, nuts and seeds and pretty low carb and so forth. And I always thought like that was good. Well, when I kind of found this world, and I'm someone that likes to go and I'm all in, and I went from no dairy to full fat dairy. I went from no butter to butter. I went from like tons of carbohydrates and sugar and sweets and all of these things like overnight. And my body was like, what are you doing? Right. So we should always, right. Even when you're eating a really crappy diet and you're going to a better diet, an extreme shift in dieting is a stress on the system. Your body just is not used to it. So it is always good to kind of take one toe in at a time when flipping to this approach, so that your body has some time to adapt to this new way, because it can freak out, and mine did. And one of the results was my cholesterol went up to 300. And I happened to go into my doctor, and she was just like, oh my God, what are you doing? Your cholesterol's through the roof. And then I realized, you know, and again, and those foods can definitely make you respond that way. But in my brain, it was kind of like, I felt like the true state of my health had just shown up. Like, okay, like my body, and it was so inflamed. Like I had so much inflammation in my system from overtraining. And I think it was just showing me what was really happening. And so it took a time, because at that point in time, I really backed off my exercise programming, and I just kind of, everything made sense to me. It just wasn't happening like I was used to. Like usually when you start a dietary approach, because you're usually restricting something, usually it will get a physical result pretty quickly, a good one, like weight loss. This one didn't really happen that way. Like I kind of like, you know, all of a sudden I kind of gained some weight, and I broke out in a rash, and all these weird things started happening to me. And then, but it all made sense. So I just kind of kept with it, and kind of soon things kind of figured themselves out.
I really hope that's encouraging for our listeners who have been in Kate's exact shoes of being the all-in type of person, because that describes a personality type that describes a specific that really driven person. And it's not, you're not alone in that. And I know that a lot of my course students have gone through that, and it can be hard to, oh my gosh, you want to reverse everything, because you're like, well, surely this can't be right if you don't understand. I guess the physiological response to a lot of these things, especially if you came from a period of restriction. So I find that really encouraging. And I'm also curious, just to add to that, if you had kind of a community at the time, or another woman or man that was kind of making changes alongside you, and if you, or that was this like, because this is kind of when you got into this, it was definitely before kind of social media has allowed. You know, go ahead.
So my first introduction was Josh Rubin. So Josh and I both were in the Czech Institute. So I've known Josh for 14 years.
Wow.
So Josh from East West Healing. And I think he kind of sort of was dabbling into it. And I also worked with, I kind of learned from Josh. I started reading, and then I worked with Lita Lee. You guys don't remember Lita Lee. Have you heard of Lita Lee? So Lita Lee was kind of doing a pro-metabolic before pro-metabolic was in. She's like 80. I don't know. She was still working with clients. So I worked with her, and she was all about the enzymes. Like she was all about the enzyme cure. She wrote a book called The Enzyme Cure. And she used this approach, but then would put you on like 50 pills. So I was taking all these enzymes. Like, I'm like, well, this doesn't feel right. I feel like I'm taking so many pills. And so then I called Josh back up, because I know he was dabbling. So I started working with Josh for a little bit, who helped me kind of flatten things out. And then I really got into reading all of Ray's work. And I was like, I turned into this weird hermit, because I was so like, it was just like making my brain hurt, but I could not stop listening to it. I would just stay home, be like, you're going to go out? I'm like, no, I got to watch Herb Doctors tonight. Right? And I'd be like, I was so like, oh my God. And I'd read it and listen to it again. I'm like, that's crazy. It was just this, like, I just felt like I had found this holy grail. Like, all the answers were here, and I couldn't stop listening to it. Because it was just making so much sense to me in this whole different level than I've ever been into, you know, because I've been in the fitness and health world for a lot of years, and I've done a lot of approaches. And I was like, holy crap, this is why I've had all these things happen all my life. And so it just finally spun me upside down, and I couldn't get away from it. I mean, I just could not stop getting, but yeah. So I had him. There was no social media at the time, so there wasn't any of these worlds to kind of go into. And everyone thought I was crazy. So
well, Kate mentioned Josh Rubin. That's Real Food Gangstas, for those of you who are listening that don't know their Instagram account. They're amazing. We hope to have them on the show at some point. And that's funny you talk about just that, like, I just want to stay home and listen to this and just can't get enough of it. That's actually how I feel still. I mean, all the time, but especially listening to Danny Roddy and Georgie and Ray whenever they get on one of their YouTube lives together. Oh my gosh, it's just, it's good stuff. So anyways, switching gears. The third kind of condition we want to talk about is depression. This is a huge topic. And if you're new here, this is the first episode you're listening to. We discussed SSRIs on the Reclaiming the Female Libido episode, just discussing, you know, the impact that SSRIs have on the libido as well as the metabolism, why serotonin is not the happy hormone, how it, you know, can decrease metabolic rate, inhibits the conversion of T4 to T3. Something I love that Dr. Pete talks about is the learned helplessness that, you know, increased or elevated serotonin can create. Can we talk about serotonin for a second? Because I feel like serotonin still might be a brand new conversation to people who have thought it was the happy hormone. You talk about serotonin a lot. I would love to hear your thoughts on just serotonin first before we kind of dive into depression.
Well, I mean, I think most people know serotonin as they think it is the happy hormone, right? Because it's it's somehow either being inhibited or not broken down or increased if you're on usually some sort of SSRI or some sort of other antidepressant. But it's essentially a neurotransmitter. It is produced primarily in the gut, about 95% of it. It is utilized a lot with gut function, gut motility. It can increase when you have any sort of gut irritation. And it essentially is not a happy hormone. It doesn't really have any relation to, it can, I guess, affect your mood as your gut can affect your mood. But ultimately what it does, it is an adaptive hormone that slows your metabolism down. And I think for some people, and the question always is like, hey, why do we feel better if our metabolism is slowing down? Because that sometimes does. Like, people do get on antidepressants and they do feel better. And the question is why? There's, to me, two reasons. One is that for the most part, give somebody a medication and you say this is going to make you feel better because our brain is so about, you know, we can change things. And Fallon, I know you know this because you've done DNRS, which the dynamic neural retraining system. So our brains are very cued into to things. And if you say this is going to make you feel better, we're immediately going to think this is going to make me feel better. So we know that SSRIs have a very strong placebo effect. By even giving someone a placebo, they can feel better. 80% of people usually feel better just by taking nothing, because you've told them they're going to feel better. And that's how powerful your brain is. Now, the antidepressants say that they can produce a little bit better response. There's some reasoning for that. Some people say if you have actually more side effects, you are tend to think that it's working more, so you are going to actually feel better. And certainly, SSRIs or any sort of antidepressant has additional side effects: low libido, gut issues, makes you colder. Basically, everything you want to know about a low metabolism, look at side effects for SSRIs or antidepressant. It's basically the exact same thing, because that's what they do. They basically put you in a state of hibernation. They slow everything down. And for some people that are in a very excitatory state or very anxious, they're basically driving their system really, really hard. They're basically, their needs are way more than their body can produce in energy. And so what happens is they get, you know, they're highly stressed. If you give them something that slows the system down, they actually will feel better. They'll feel less anxious. They'll feel less out of control. And so for them, it does help. But it's not helping in the way that you want it to. it's actually supporting the system in that slow. And that's why so many people get on SSRIs and they gain weight and mm-hmm. they start losing sleep. A lot of different things can happen to them. And again, I don't want to tell anyone to get off your SSRIs or get off if you are on one, definitely talk to your doctor. There's the right way to do that. But I think there needs to be an understanding because I think so many people go through this process and get on 17 different ones and try different ones. And this one didn't work, but now it doesn't work. And it's like, well, what is really going on and what is this thing doing to you?
Absolutely. There's actually have you read the meta-analysis? I know Chris Kresser talks about it. He has like a whole review of the meta-analysis, but it's the big meta-analysis where they were looking at the placebo versus the antidepressant and how there was no difference in between, you know, the effects.
I suggest everybody read this book. It's called The Emperor's New Drug by Irving Kirsch. So I think he's a British guy. He did this whole like long-term, here you go.
There you go. Oh, that's amazing.
Anyways, it is a great book and it totally debunks the entire antidepressant world. It talks about all the studies, he goes through all of them and how did they get to where they're going, and he dissects the ones they left out. And I mean, he just kind of totally goes through all of it. And even the people that are like the biggest advocates of antidepressants will even say in there, like, these drugs should only be taken for a very short period of time. These should not be ongoing drugs. Yet again, it's very profitable to have a drug that people takes all the time. Like, you know, I'm not against drugs. I think there probably are some really good drugs out there. I think they should be used as a mediator between, you know, giving you time to work on the things to make yourself feel better. You know, maybe if you need to be on an antidepressant so that you can do the things that help support you and then remove yourself. But to be on them indefinitely and to not change anything is the absolute worst thing you probably can possibly do. But that is the best business model for every drug company.
Absolutely. I mean, it's a very interesting topic. I think it was it Germany that had the biggest pushback against, I believe it was not Zoloft, Prozac. I think it was Prozac. So like Prozac was being introduced to Germany. They had this big pushback, because they were seeing, whenever they showed them, I guess, the clinical trials, they were like, well, if we introduce this into our system, there's going to be an increased rate of suicide.
That's right. Versus
if we don't introduce them at all. Yeah. And there was some really, really messy stuff that happened after that. But going back to the serotonin topic, essentially what I learned whenever I started studying Ray's work is that elevated serotonin could potentially be the root cause, you know, not necessarily the one root cause because it's all energetic, but I'm saying it's interesting. And this is what we talked about on the libido episode, is that SSRIs are what are given, but elevated serotonin in the first place can create feelings of depression.
Yeah. I mean, I think anytime you have any of the adaptive hormones, because usually when you go into the stress, like as soon as your system, and when I say stress, I always want to put it as your body goes under stress the moment that it cannot produce enough energy to support the demands placed upon it. So when the body can't produce energy, it's like, oh, we're going to start stressing and trying to burn off other measures. And when we hit into stress, we're trying to lower thyroid function. So we'll lower the demands internally. So all the things you don't need to keep alive, like digestion and libido and hormone function, like, yep, well, those are important, but you won't die if you don't have the energy demands there, right? But your brain will die and your heart and all these things need to be running. And so there's other things kind of shut down. That's why I think when the majority, probably the people you talk to, I talk to, what do they have? GI issues, hormone issues. Those are probably the two biggest. And then the other factors, like a headaches or the other, but they're always integrated usually with those things. And so when you start addressing those and you're starting to go like, what is happening there? Yes, one of them is certainly serotonin. Others are, because serotonin is very much involved in a lot of GI issues, and that, you know, you're usually going to get it with cortisol and adrenaline, and then you'll see the histamine going off in there and probably estrogen. So they all kind of go together. Mm-hmm. And I think, because people are always like, well, why is that person have a GI issue and that one has a hormonal issue? And, you know, and why do the people have different symptoms? And ultimately, it's probably, I always look at it, I guess it's wherever the Achilles heel is in that person. Doesn't mean they're not going to eventually have the other ones, but it's like, I think everyone has a breaking point somewhere. And it could be that, all right, that's your period's the thing that's going to get affected first. But, you know, normally there's always the period, the GI issues always go together. There seems to be that break there. But ultimately, you know, the more you push into that stress path, the more symptoms you're always going to see.
Mm-hmm. I love the analogy of the Achilles heel. That's fantastic. And I feel like that puts into perspective and answers that question that some people might have. And going back to learned helplessness, okay, because this is such an interesting topic to me. This is another thing that, you know, Ray has, again, with that zoom out analogy, like being able to explain even just a state, an emotional state, or a, like something you would label maybe as your personality, can have, there's an energetic explanation for that too. So I would love to hear your definition of learned helplessness.
Well, essentially is when an individual has the resources to do something, but just decides they can't. Essentially, you don't think you can. And even though you're there. So I think they always give you the analogy of like, you're teaching people to not be able to take care of themselves.
Mm.
Basically kind of what our government's doing. I mean,
well but, said.
But when people feel like they can't do it, right? And they almost developed like a victim mentality. Even though you can, the resources are there, but you basically decide you can't, right? They did, like I said, they do it with the rats. They teach them that they can't get out of the pool, and then they put a ladder down, but they've learned that they can't get out of the pool, so they still drown. And so that's essentially what happens with antidepressant. Anyone that's ever been on an antidepressant will tell you, yeah, I just felt totally disconnected. I didn't care. And then you're not as anxious because you don't care as much. And so you're a little bit disconnected from things, but you're also just they can't help themselves. And a good book, I think, to read is, I don't know if you guys have read this, called The Lost Connections by Johanna Hari. He talks about depression, but he also gives other routes of why people are getting depressed. And usually it's because lack of purpose, lack of community, not being into nature, you know, all of these things that we need to be connected to as human beings that, hey, maybe in the last 24 months you haven't been, because we've been in just this crazy world of disconnection, isolation, non-community, fear. And sadly, I mean, this is a whole nother topic, but hey, when you get people to totally be disconnected from their beings, the people around them, their community, into the earth, because they're not outside in nature anymore, they are very scared and frightened, and they're very easy to control. Mm-hmm. And so we've created this weird world. And so people start to think the only way they can help themselves at this point in time is with this medication that is being pushed onto people, when in fact that is insane. And, you know, literally when we go back to just we as humans and beings, like, we are in complete control and we have so much that we can do for ourselves. But again, if you don't, you're going to be in a lot of trouble. But when you start to be able to think for yourself and get out of that space of learned helplessness, that you can change, you can do all these things, but you are affected hormonally by that situation, also by the exterior world. It definitely freaks me out, because I feel like there's a lot of that going on in today's world. And so when you get into this world and you start to unravel the things and you become more open and become healthier, you start to see things you can't unsee.
Absolutely. Gosh, that was so well said. And to give one personal experience that this just reminded me of, I forget all the time that this happened, but when I was a freshman in college, I got sick multiple times in a row. It was a very unhealthy time in my life. My university wouldn't honor my sick, you know, I don't even know what you call that. The doctor's note saying, hey, she was in the hospital. They weren't honoring it. I ended up failing, two classes. It was a very stressful time in my life. And I started feeling anxious. And I remember I had a panic attack. I go into like a clinic. They're like, you definitely have anxiety. Here's, you know, some anti-anxiety drugs. And I remember my parents being like, do you need that? Like, I'm not really understanding, like, you know, can we talk about the full picture here? But I was like, I need this. Like, I for sure need this. I was on them for 2 months. And I remember during that time, almost immediately, I remember I had a friend whose boyfriend cheated on her. They broke up. She's sobbing. She's telling me the story. And I'm just like, dude, get over it. You know, they're just so, is apathetic the right word? Just completely apathetic to the situation. And so that really, everything you just said really resonates with my own personal experience being on them, of isolation, not investing in my community, just kind of the spiral that even comes from that alone. And I remember I made a choice to flush them down the toilet one day because I just woke up one day and believed that I could heal. I was just like, I can heal. Like I fully believe that I can heal, flush them down the toilet, and never had a symptom of anxiety, you know, following that season. And it's just so interesting how powerful, going back to your first point of just how powerful our brains are. So I appreciate that whole perspective.
Yeah. I mean, and like I said, and I mean, I've had, you know, even in my journey in the last 12 years, and like, again, I mean, and I know Fallon's done the dynamic neural retraining system, and I can't ever push that program enough because it is essentially just about you being able to control your thoughts, and not only control your thoughts, because that's just part of the piece. It's creating a feeling. And when you feel better, and when you feel that whatever it is that you're trying to create, and that feeling will create a behavior. So we go through that thoughts, feeling, behavior. And when you know you can, you actually can do that, and you can change it, even though you might feel crappy initially, but you, if you start shifting and just working within that small part of you that you know that can feel better, you can change your entire dynamic, whatever it is that you're trying to work mm-hmm. yourself through. And so that to me, you know, like I said, healing is not just about diet. It's certainly about your thoughts as well, and certainly your environment. And I always believe sleep is that other huge component.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, we need to have like a full-blown conversation sometime about brain rewiring. Honestly, it's such a beautiful concept. But, and I really love this holistic high-level view of things like depression and anxiety, because I think even in sort of the more functional medicine sphere, there can be sort of, like you said, Kate, this swing toward like, oh, well, it's all about your diet. Like, just clean up your diet, then you're going to feel better. And that's just not the case. Like, it's really so complex. And I think you did a post actually within the year, just kind of summarizing, you know, things to sort of consider if you're experiencing depression. And I thought that was a super great summary of some things to consider. And I remember you drawing attention to like community and being around people and, you know, look at the state of the world over this past year. I mean, I've wrestled with a lot of just really tough mental stuff, and I eat fantastically well. You know, it's not just about like, it is about nutrients, and it is about your fuel, and it is about all of that, but it's also about all of these other things. And so I think that's just amazing that we got to have that conversation today. Let's skirt to a different issue here, because we've got a few more like super fun things to talk about. So the next one, let's talk about diabetes, specifically type 2. But Kate, I mean, if you want to chime in with thoughts on type 1 as well, feel free to. But let's talk in light of, you know, sugar causes diabetes. So, you know, we know the standard recommendations are don't eat sugar and avoid carbs, you know, or you're going to develop and or worsen your diabetic state, which can feel really confusing for anyone who has started learning about the metabolic approach, where sugar and carbs are praised and encouraged in the right context. And I think even if our listeners are not currently diabetic, you know, the number of people who are living with really severe blood sugar dysregulation is astonishing. I mean, I did for years and years and years, had no idea. And to me, you know, regulating your blood sugar is one of the most crucial components of regaining and maintaining health. So Kate, can you help walk us through where the misunderstandings surrounding diabetes lie?
Right. And any, like you said, anytime you want to talk about something fun, you go right to diabetes.
It's a party.
Right. So yes, we all know as diabetes as the sugar disease. And because again, it has usually one of the symptoms is high blood sugar or hyperglycemia. And so, and if you have it for a significant amount of time, then they will test your A1C and then they'll say, hey, if you're in this range, now you have diabetes. The question is, why is the sugar still in your blood? And is it just the sugar's fault? And normally the answer is no. And the reason we know that is because there's a significant amount of research that shows back into the 1940s. I always like to reference Walter Kempner because I think he did such a cool study on and created such a cool diet called the rice diet, where he basically gave people a diet of 95% carbohydrates. And even though he wasn't really trying to cure diabetes, he was trying to fix kidney issues or glaucoma or heart issues. But eventually he even had his diabetic patients come out, and they basically were cured, or most of them were cured of their diabetic state. Even ones that were insulin dependent got off their insulin. So if you're giving a diabetic a 95% carbohydrate diet and they're being cured, then we know that, hey, maybe it's not sugar is the issue. So what essentially is the issue? Usually it's the combination, or within the blood, it's a, most diabetics have usually high fat, high free fatty acids in their blood, as well as sugar. And essentially their cells at some point in time are not able to metabolize the sugar properly. So either the sugar is getting kind of stuck in the cell and it can't be utilized as energy, or it's not getting into this tissue at all, because essentially the fat within the blood is hindering the sugar to get into the cell, which we reference as the Randall cycle. So that's that fatty acid glucose metabolism, and they start to compete with each other. And so what ends up happening is, because there's too much fat in the blood, or the sugar isn't able to metabolize the sugar properly, sugar gets backed up, stays in the blood, creates essentially insulin to continue to rise, and essentially you're starting to create insulin resistance, which will eventually lead to that diabetic state. And so that result of having high fat, high sugar is normally a body, wait for it, under stress. And in that stressed metabolism, usually what you'll see in the, like somebody that's diabetic, right? And so if you actually look at a true diabetic, what you'll see is a lot of the times they have very thin limbs and a big belly. So they have what they'll refer to that like cortisol belly, and have lots of weight without in the middle. They might also have a lot of estrogen, especially if they're women. So you'll start seeing a lot of weight around their bigger chest and around the back, but their limbs will be quite small. And that's usually the result, because their body's been under significant amount of stress. Maybe it's not regulating their blood sugar properly. And what happens is their body's breaking down tissue to try to regulate their blood sugar. So when your body gets under stress, if you don't have enough sugar available, it's going to go after your muscle tissue, thymus gland, connective tissue, break it down and convert it through a process called gluconeogenesis into sugar to keep you regulated. The problem is when that cycle starts happening and you become also have, and what also happens at that point in time is your body's breaking down fat, or through the breaking down fatty acids, you get a flush of fat, sugar in the blood. And if that happens long enough or in excess, there's going to start to become a problem with metabolizing that. So then when those people then eat, if they're not eating well anyways, they're eating cookies and cakes and crap and all this other garbage, well, that just adds fuel to the fire and creates more of an issue. So the real the problem is usually it's high fat, high sugar in the blood. That can be the result of a very stressed body or somebody that's chronically eating a high fat, high sugar diet. And usually it's not necessarily, let's say, the fat that you might find in like something like milk. It's more of the fat you might find in cookies and cakes and all these other foods that have more of the vegetable oils or the poop oils in there, because that's usually what's creating more of the problems in certainly the diabetic person. So it's like a high PUFA diet, could be excess calories. Usually there's some sort of excess stress is going on. They aren't metabolizing the sugar properly, staying in the blood. And again, everybody points to sugar like they just point to salt or they point to cholesterol. That seems to be the logical thing. So they put them on a reduced sugar diet, or at least something that maybe it will regulate them somehow. And usually that doesn't ever fix the problem though. It just kind of perpetuates it. And so, you know, we do see results in a very low, low, low fat diet can produce a good result. You can also see it kind of correct in a low, low carbohydrate. You also see that can kind of be corrected in the keto diet. Well, I say symptomatically, you can reduce their blood sugar, but it doesn't seem to fix the cellular issue at that point in time, because if you add sugar back in, it ends up not being able to be metabolized again. So the end result is fixing the diabetic state, I guess, isn't really there's not a quick answer to that. I think it depends on the person. But usually it's a result of removing the PUFA, eating more foods that might not have such a high glycemic index, like fruit sugar, something that have fructose in it. Potassium is also a nutrient that has insulinic response, so that can kind of fix things as well. And kind of making sure that proteins and fats and so forth are combined to help regulate the blood sugar.
Yeah, and I think that the glycemic index is also one of those conversations where people are like, huh? Like, what do you, I thought that, you know, fruit was the worst, or like fruit juice was the worst. And you actually talk about glycemic index in perspective in your book as well. Everybody just go get her book. Go get her book right now. It's so fantastic. I love this. There's a podcast interview where Georgie went on Kitty's podcast. It's called the Win at Life podcast. I may just link it in the show notes, but he was talking about the relationship with stress and diabetes, and was talking about man, I'm going to mix up if it was type 2 or type 1, but it was something about if a child and there's a significant car accident and there's like trauma on the body and the child perceives, you know, stress and trauma, that can even create diabetes as well. So the conversation of stress is just so important in this context.
Yeah. I think just how the medical world, diagnostic things, the tests that they use to look at diabetes. I mean, they don't look, and they probably should measure things like cortisol, right? Because we know that blood sugar isn't high just because of insulin resistance. Insulin is just one hormone that is a regulator of blood sugar. Cortisol, adrenaline, thyroid, glucagon, potassium, all of these things can play a role in somebody's blood sugar. You can have elevated blood sugar under stress, right? We also know that like bears that hibernate during the wintertime, when they come out of hibernation, they are diabetic by testing. We know that kids that are sick for a severe amount of time, which is a stress, if you actually check them, they would show up as high blood sugar. They would actually be considered a diabetic state. But what we just need to do is get the system out of stress, right? If you don't eat for a significant amount of time, that is a severe amount of stress on your system. You take someone's blood sugar, it can be off. And so we have to put everything in context and understand what is the organism going through, the person going through that might be creating this response, and can we change that biologically with food or change of environment without just throwing like insulin at them or putting them on some sort of diet that's going to just remove the sugar in their blood versus address why is their system not able to regulate and utilize these fuel sources. And I think there's a lot more questions that we have to be asking somebody until we just give them a drug for that they can put on the rest of the life that again, is probably not going to fix the problem.
I think it literally just comes down to asking why. Like if you just start with that question alone, it's going to unravel that there is a much bigger picture at play here. And last but not least, we're going to talk about heart disease. Kate, you mentioned the China study in your book, and then you talk about how, I think it was Cordain, her work, how she was reporting that, you know, eating a high animal protein diet can actually reduce the risk of heart disease, and yet we also have information saying, okay, well, plant-based is how you reduce the risk of heart disease. Clearly, there's a lot of conflicting information out there. We're not shy in saying that. There is a lot of conflicting information. And that's just why I find it incredibly valuable to be able to, again, zoom out. And maybe we won't have to hyper-focus so strongly on, is it the red meat? Is it not the red meat? You know, and just talk about more of the energetic conversation with heart disease. But do you want to touch on heart disease in context of, you know, saturated fats and all? It's kind of going hand in hand with hypertension too.
Yeah, I think that comes down to, and I've had these conversations before, because there's certainly, when you just look at diet alone, a very high carbohydrate, low fat diet can cure someone of heart disease, right? We've seen that in Kepner, we've seen that in John McDougall that did the starch diet. I mean, there's a lot of researchers from back when that actually use these very low carbohydrate diets to cure everything from muscular dystrophy, multiple sclerosis, heart disease, diabetes. And I think the common thing is primarily is you remove a bunch of garbage when you actually eliminate a lot of these foods that are beneficial to somebody. So you can eat high carbohydrates, high fruit, remove heart disease. You can also on the other end of the spectrum, actually eat a high saturated fat, high meat diets, remove a lot of these other processed garbage foods and can increase or improve heart disease. So the question is, well, it can't be either or of those. And again, what is it? It comes down to, well, we go back to like, is this the Achilles heel of somebody? Because under stress, now, of course, I'm not going to take out that there can be genetic components to some of these disorders or diseases. I usually like to think that's 5% of the problems. Most of them are down to some sort of metabolic issue. But yeah, under stress, the system, the heart is not going to regulate properly. And is that going to be the thing that your body shows up, right? Because we know, again, if we don't have enough minerals, we don't have enough nutrients, we don't have enough system or fuel, then our biology is going to start breaking down somewhere. And if it becomes into the heart, is it necessarily saturated fat? No. But is it a complex issue of a diet filled with excessive amounts of trans fats, hydrogenated oils, processed foods, high stress? All of those things can play a factor.
Yeah, I don't think we've talked about Ansel Keys yet on this episode, but maybe we can talk about him for a second and what, I mean, your book explains this as well. Did we talk about Ansel Keys? I can't even remember.
We didn't. No. Yeah, the 7 country study.
Yes. Can you kind of explain what happened there?
Well, he did a study where he kind of excluded things. And so, but I think it was called the 7 country study. And he just found that these cultures that had very low saturated fats in their diet had low amounts of heart disease. But what he left out was other countries like France or Holland that actually have a significantly high amounts of saturated fat also had low heart disease. And also there were countries that had very low saturated fat levels and had high amounts of heart disease. I think it was like Chile. I can't remember the countries in particular, but basically he created this hypothesis based on his limited or his preferred resources that he used to support it, but kind of left out some data that maybe would ask more questions. But from that, I think that's where part of the time period where we decided that saturated fats were bad. It was probably during the term of George McGovern changed kind of the USDA guidelines and decided at that point that, hey, we need less saturated fat. That's going to be better for us. And we need more carbohydrates. Interesting, because that was kind of during the 1970s, I think. That was probably around the time that the whole obesity epidemic started.
Yeah.
But what is interesting during that time period that we did start eating more carbohydrates, we never ate less fat though. We always ate the same amount. We just ate less saturated fat. And that was kind of the time period we started adding more of the vegetable oils, the Mazola time, the PUFAs, everything was coming out that like started eating these oils are way better. They're heart healthy because they lower cholesterol. And so we flipped. So we ate at the same amount of fats. We started eating more PUFAs and then we ate more carbs and they were usually more processed carbs because that was kind of when all of us started eating more packaged, crappy, you know, easy food. And what started happening is, you know, everyone started getting fatter. And essentially that's what has led to where we are today.
Absolutely. I think that we probably linked the OG Ray Peet, article where he goes into the history of polyunsaturated oils and vegetable oils and all of that. But if we haven't, we're going to relink that in the show notes of this as well, because that is a great read.
This has been such an amazing conversation, Kate. Let's to wrap up, we would love to give a really good, solid definition of what actually defines health, because we know that, the topics that we covered today are, you know, really important in terms of looking at your health, but they're also pretty mainstream. So a standard doctor is going to be looking at some of these markers. And Kate, you had a fantastic snippet toward the beginning of the episode where you did really give a good look into, you know, metabolic markers versus standard blood draws. But, you know, kind of piggybacking off of that, Kate, do you want to wrap us up by giving us your personal sort of checklist and definition of what health looks like?
So for me at this point in my life, health looks like a few things, great sleep, great energy all day long, the ability to have a bowel movement at least once a day, to be urinating 4 to 5 times a day, not 20 as so many people are, pain-free periods, good libido, and a general feeling of well-being, and also the ability to not have to work out to stay thin. I lived like that my whole life. I literally was so psychotic that, I mean, I could not miss a workout because I would get fat the next day or whatever I thought was going to happen. Whereas now life is much more free. I don't worry. If I don't work out, I don't even care. I work out because I want to, because it makes me feel good, but not before I feel like I'm going to gain weight because I know I'm not going to. When you have good metabolic health, you don't have to live in that paradigm. Your body is able to adapt. And if you don't work out for a little bit, it's actually can be good for it. So I guess, and of course, in a measurement, that means, you know, a warm body, temperature and pulse, temperature, you know, getting up to 98.6, good pulse around 75, 90 beats per minute. Yeah, I think a general just good outlet of life is a very important factor.
Mm-hmm. That was so well said. Yeah, I think once again, your story being in the fitness industry for so long, and what you went through with that and your description of putting duct tape on everything towards the beginning of the episode is just incredibly relatable. And I know that that was the trajectory I was headed down had I stayed in that mindset as well. I was 100% in that mindset of I have to work out every single day, just such an addiction to it. So your perspective is just so refreshing. Your story is so refreshing. Also your humility and your honesty about your story as well, and just how much has changed throughout your life, and just the way that you present that information to others. We just appreciate it so much. And thank you so much for being on today.
Well, thank you, both of you ladies. I think you're doing awesome work, and I'm always very privileged that we're all part of this community together. I think, you know, I embrace more people because I think more people need to hear this message. So, you know, thank you for letting me come on your show.
Thank you. And we will see you guys in the next episode.